And our next speaker that we bring to the stage here in a second has traveled the furthest. He has come to us from California. He originally was born in Saudi Arabia. He then graduated from Harvard. He may burn his diploma on stage, but we'll get to that later. And he now has he wrote a book that made on the New York Best Time Seller list. And now he is a co-host of a podcast called Mixed Mental Arts, which I am a personal big fan of. And he is the reason he's here. So if you don't like him, don't tell me, please. So without further ado, Hunter Motz.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, thanks so much for having me in Detroit. If you don't like me, please do tell me, because I'm always looking for an opportunity to improve. So Detroit right now is, you've had two golden ages. You had one with the automotive industry, you had one with Motown, and now you're about to embark on your third golden age. And the question is, how do you keep this one going? What makes a golden age? What is the secret sauce behind one? And so that's what we're going to take a look at today. So, your community is a classroom. This is where I did, started off my career, was working in education. And of course, we all know Ferris Bueller's Day Off. And let's just take a look at this classroom and Ferris Bueller's Day Off and see what we notice. And Brad, if you could cue up the video, that would be great.
In 1930, the Republican-controlled House of Representatives, in an effort to alleviate the effects of the Great Depression, passed the tariff bill, the Hawley-Smoot Tariff Act, which raised tariffs in an effort to collect more revenue for the federal government. Did it work? Anyone know the effects? It did not work, and the United States sank deeper into the Great Depression. Today, we have a similar debate over this. Anyone know what this is, class? Anyone? Anyone seen this before? The Laffer Curve. Anyone know what this says? It says that at this point on the revenue curve, you will get exactly the same amount of revenue as at this point. This is very controversial. Does anyone know what Vice President Bush called this in 1980? Anyone? Something D-O-O economics. Voodoo economics.
Right. So, if we look around that classroom, we see a whole bunch of faces. Now, I majored in biochemistry, and as Derek said, I grew up all over the world, and my co-host on Mixed Mental Arts, Brian Cowan, likes to joke that we saw great poverty from inside an air-conditioned car. And that really was it is. And when you're sitting in that air-conditioned car and you're seeing people starving, really struggling, you're trying to figure out, clearly, how did I get here? A pure accident of birth. And then what you're trying to figure out is, where does this prosperity come from, and how can we make sure that everybody gets it? And so I ended up going into education because of that, because obviously education is foundational to prosperity. And one of the things that you notice when you work in education is what is on people's faces. And if we look at these five faces, and there are five really important faces there, we can notice that there are totally different emotional information being communicated. So, in the top left, the top right, and the bottom left, we have, what would we describe that expression as? Yeah, some mixture of confusion, boredom, disengagement, apathy, those sorts of emotions. And on the other hand, in the bottom right, which I couldn't even find someone in Ferris Bueller's Day Off who looked this excited, but we have, what would we describe these emotions as? Come on, this is interactive, class. Excitement, exactly. They're pumped. They're so stoked. And what are they stoked about? I mean, she's in awe of the teacher. Maybe she has the hots for the teacher, or maybe she has the hots for the subject. He, on the other hand, is in awe of her. He has the hots for her, or he's in awe of her. And that emotion of excitement and awe and being really, really stoked is great for information transfer. So what your emotions are is they're essentially your emotional bandwidth. Think of it as your Wi-Fi. So think of the old Verizon ad, can you hear me now? Well, the point is that those students, those top three students, they can't hear anything that's being said because they're in an emotional state that shuts down communication. On the other hand, in the bottom right-hand corner, those people are so fired up. They're going to learn so much. And it's not because their brains are different. It's because their brains are in a different emotional state. And so, you know, when we ended up working through all of the neuroscience, we ended up writing the book that we wish we'd always had in school. So everybody gets a human brain. Congratulations, you won the species lottery. You're part of the smartest species. But not everybody gets a manual on how to use that brain. In fact, nobody does. So it's very much like students being asked to drive a car. You just stick them in a car, and then you're like, hey, you have to figure out all this material. And they have no idea how to do it. So we basically started to break down all of that science into a form that students could actually use. What's the playbook? How do you make this thing do what you want? How do you make it generate prosperity? How do you make it generate learning? How do you create great relationships? And you may recognize this man, Steve Jobs. Now, a lot of people have internalized this idea that some people are naturally smart. And that's a large part of why we wrote The Straight-A Conspiracy. We heard people say, oh, I'm not a natural reader, or I didn't get the math gene, or I don't have an ear for languages. Well, what does Steve Jobs say about smart?
When you grow up, you tend to get told that the world is the way it is, and your life is just to live your life inside the world, try not to bash into the walls too much, try to have a nice family life, have fun, save a little money. That's a very limited life. Life can be much broader once you discover one simple fact, and that is everything around you that you call life was made up by people that were no smarter than you. And you can change it. You can influence it. You can build your own things that other people can use. Once you learn that, you'll never be the same again.
And my job today is to make sure that you learn that today. That you learn that the world really was built by people no smarter than you, and that you can remake it in any way that you want. Now, although that may be what Steve Jobs says on this relatively unknown video clip on YouTube, that's certainly not the image that he created. Instead, the image that we have of people like Steve Jobs is of him as the eye god. And it's literally, that's the point, is that he's a modern deity, and he creates a whole cult of personality around him. And this playbook was an old playbook. It's the same playbook that was used by Thomas Edison, who branded himself as the Wizard of Menlo Park. Now, why are they creating these cults of personality? Well, it's for a very simple reason. Because advertisers' favorite emotion is the emotion of awe. So awe is the emotion by which we transmit culture. So you're in awe of your, you know, older brother, or you're in awe of your big sister, or you're in awe of, you know, some celebrity, and you want to be just like them. So you blindly copy everything that they do because you're trying to get success. So you're trying to download everything they've got. And in a small village way, way back 10,000 years ago, 100,000 years ago, you would actually get to meet your heroes. So you would spend time with them, you would cozy up to them, and then over the course of 10,000 hours, you would internalize everything they knew. But now, most of us do not meet our heroes. So all we see is that magazine cover. And advertisers have figured this out. It's very smart. So what they know is that there are lots of kids who are in awe of Michael Jordan. And so they know that if they place an object next to Michael Jordan's head, that kids will blindly copy it. Now, the point is that the real thing? Is that really how Michael Jordan got so good at basketball? Is it drinking carbonated sugar water that is artificially flavored? No, it is not. Nor is it his puffy sneakers. In fact, the success of Michael Jordan rests on a lot of practice that we never, ever get to see. It's that invisible work that is the real key to Michael Jordan's success. But in a large-scale society in an age of mass media, this works really well. The problem is this can do a lot of damage to kids because kids, frankly, are dumb. They have a tendency to stick their fingers in electrical sockets. They eat things that aren't, you know, good for them. And they need adults to take care of them and show them what is safe, what is healthy, what is good for them. And there's been a lot of controversy recently around the photoshopping of supermodels because advertisers create this better than perfect image. The kids don't know that that's not attainable for them, and so therefore they make themselves sick and unhealthy in the pursuit of what everybody is idolizing. And it's exactly the same thing with these genius myths. And that's what people like Jobs and Edison and Einstein and Newton and Mozart and Michael Jackson created. People don't understand that the image of the eye god is not real. That isn't the real secret of Steve Jobs' success. The secret of Steve Jobs' success is not that he's smarter than everyone, it's that he knows that no one is smarter than him, that there are no magical people. And in fact, that is the point of The Wizard of Oz. So, Brad, if we could
Do not arouse the wrath of the great and powerful Oz. I said, come back tomorrow.
If you are really great and powerful, you'll keep your promises.
Do you presume to criticize the great Oz? You ungrateful creatures, think yourselves lucky that I'm giving you audience tomorrow instead of 20 years from now.
Oh.
The great Oz has spoken.
Oh.
Pay no attention to that man behind the curtain. The great Oz has spoken.
Who are you?
Oh, I am the great and powerful Wizard of Oz.
You are? I don't believe you.
No, I'm afraid it's true. There's no other wizard except me.
You humbug!
Yes, it's exactly so. I'm a humbug.
Oh, you're a very bad man.
And that is the thing. There have been some people who have done very well for themselves financially by being very bad men. And that's because they've created this image of a wizard. And, you know, what Toto does is he pulls back the curtain and he invites everybody to look for themselves, to peer behind the curtain and see what's really there. And in the mixed metal arts community, we like nicknames, and my nickname is Toto. So my mom's from Kansas City, and so I thought this was an appropriate nickname. And my job is to pull back the curtain, and then you can look for yourself. But the key thing here is that you don't have to believe me. You can be your own Toto. And so pick whoever your hero is and whatever image they've cultivated of themselves, and look behind the curtain. See what's actually there. How did they actually succeed? And that is part of how you have this great insight that Steve Jobs got, is by looking at how did people actually succeed, not the myth or the image that they have created. And what you'll find is that the same patterns in these stories repeat again and again throughout history. So, for example, look at these two young men. On the left, we have Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart, and on the right, we have, am I getting this right? It's backwards. Anyway, Michael Jackson is right there. And so Michael Jackson and Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart actually had very similar childhoods. They both had stage dads. So Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart's father was the premier violin teacher in Europe at the time, and he figured out that there's this great money-making scheme, which is that you take your child, you make them practice obsessively, and then you send them out into the world to go and do shows. And Wolfgang actually had an older sister named Nannerl, who was the eldest of the Mozart two. She did pretty well, but then at the time in Europe, it was seen as unseemly for women to be performing because it was associated with prostitution. So aged 18, her career gets cut off, and then Mozart becomes the big star. Obviously, Joe Jackson practiced on all of the Jackson kids, and then Michael was so young that by the time he got to Michael, he'd really sort of figured out, how do you do this? How do you turn kids into these singing, dancing machines? But then both of them ended up practicing and performing for their whole childhoods and becoming so good at what they did that then they had the potential to innovate musically. So they were able to do things that nobody had ever done before. But the point is that it wasn't that Mozart was born composing masterpieces. No, he did 10,000 hours of practice, and he also had a super creepy stage dad. And obviously we can think of lots of analogies in sports, you know, Tiger Woods, Andre Agassi. It is this process of it just takes a lot of practice to get really, really good at things. And of course, you know, the Steve Jobs of his day, Henry Ford, Detroit's own, said, whether you think you can or can't, either way, you are right. And a lot of this comes down to what do you believe? And it's about what emotional state are you sitting in? Do you have the confidence that, you know, if you just keep plugging it away at this, that you will ultimately figure that out? And on the small microcosm scale of school, you see this all the time. Some students really think that if they keep chipping away at material, they'll figure it out, and that with enough practice, you can get good at anything. It's what Carol Dweck calls a growth mindset. And some students are like, no matter what I do, I'll never be good at this. But those emotional states can be changed very quickly by telling yourself a different story, right? So you can move from telling yourself the self-defeating story to telling yourself a very exciting, positive story. And that works not only on the level of an individual student or an individual classroom, but it can work on the level of a whole civilization. So, humanity has had multiple golden ages at this point. You can go any culture, any group of people, doesn't matter what the skin color is, what the culture of origin is, periodically, humanity has figured out something. And we've gotten really good at doing things, and we've outdone ourselves. We've surpassed ourselves in ways we didn't think possible. And so it's now time to ask ourselves, what is the secret sauce of a golden age? How do we replicate it? How do we bottle it? And how do we sustainably mass produce it? And the answer is actually hidden in a super academic book that most of you have probably never read or heard of, but as Derek Shinska and anyone who listens to the Mixed Mental Arts podcast knows, I cannot shut up about. And that's the secret of our success. And the reason why it comes out of Harvard, Joe Henrich, and it's all about why are humans the most successful animal? Why have we come to dominate the planet? And what you can see there in that progression is that it's because we are the cultural ape. We have the ability to constantly expand our toolkit. And we have done that successively over time. And if we want to outdo ourselves, if we want to have a golden age, then we're all going to have to expand our toolkits. And the question is, how do we do that? Well, firstly, let's just acknowledge the elephant in the room. The idea that we're going to sustainably create golden ages that are able to endure for long periods of time sounds crazy. And it sounds crazy because it hasn't been done before. And that's because everything that humans do begin as magic. Right? We don't understand why disease happens. We don't understand why lightning happens. We don't understand why golden age happens. But then, at a certain point, we start to understand why. We figure out the science. Oh, it turns out that this disease thing is linked to these tiny microorganisms. Or it turns out that this lightning thing seems to have something to do with these things called electrons. And then ultimately, we've taken that insight into how things work, and we turn it into engineering. It now becomes a sustainable process by which we are able to produce the results that we want. And that's, by the end, you have literally put lightning in a bottle, which is pretty amazing. Or you've figured out how to prevent diseases or how to treat or cure diseases. That is the great progression. And the first thing to realize is, why do humans think magically? And this is from Joe Henrich's The Secret of Our Success. And what you can see here is an IQ test given to a chimp, an orangutan, and a human toddler. And it's important to know that on causality, figuring out that big why of things happen, we are dumber than chimps as toddlers, okay? So just to put us in our place in the grand scheme of things, we are dumber than chimps as toddlers. But we have the ability to improve our understanding of why things happen over time. We now understand more about why diseases happen, and that gives us more control over what we want. We understand more about why lightning happens, so we can put up lightning rods, and we can actually channel electricity to serve us, to work for us. Now, all of this that I'm giving you exists in the science. It's out there if you want. There are 60 million scientific papers. Have at it. Go read it if you'd like. Now, it's the job of scientists to figure out why things happen. Now, there's an old story from India, the story of the blind men and the elephant. And the story is that a group of blind men decide that they're going to come along and they're going to figure out what this big hunking thing is. So the first guy, he walks up to the tail, he feels the end of the tail, and the blind man says, "It's a rope!" And then the second blind man walks up to the trunk, and he feels it, and he grabs it, starts wriggling in his hands, and he says, "It's a snake!" And then on and on, and the guy feels the side, he decides it's a wall. The guy feels the legs, and he decides that it's a tree trunk. And this is the picture of the elephant that they come up with. And then they decide that everybody else around the elephant is an idiot. And that's a lot of what's going on right now politically, right? We see the world as it is, but those other guys, they're idiots who are blinded by their ideology or their self-interest or whatever it may be. And if you look at science, if you were to work your way around the 60 million scientific journal articles, it looks a lot like this. It's a mess, right? And theoretically, they're all describing reality, but they don't seem to add up to anything. And that's why, you know, after interviewing 200 different scientists, we realized that it was a lot like, there's a famous George Bernard Shaw quote, that if you took all the economists and laid them end to end, they would never reach a conclusion. And so, you know, because that's the point. Economics is supposed to figure out how do we get prosperity. That's what we actually want. Doesn't seem to be much clarity on that, guys. So it's the same thing with science. And so we decided, you know, academics are going to squabble over their stuff. Why not have an online community that just goes ahead and tries to figure out what the elephant looks like? And that's what Mixed Mental Arts is about. And you find that academics have figured out a lot of great things, like in Joe Henrich's The Secret of Our Success. Notably, what is humanity's superpower? So Carrie has talked about your individual superpowers, but what is it that makes humans special? And what makes humans special is that we are the social ape. We are amazing at learning from each other. Scattered around this room, you know, this is what Carrie's saying. There are all sorts of skills and knowledge resources. There are people who understand the law, people who understand accounting, people who understand the automotive industry, you know, and if you want to solve all of these things, you get these people working together. You know, Mark had this great story about how in the 1970s they were trying to figure out what do women want. Turned out there was no women there. It's pretty hard to figure out what women want if there are no women there. Much easier to just invite a woman into the conversation, and then we can all figure out that problem together. So this is our collective superpower, is the ability to figure out things together. And here we are now. Detroit has had its two golden ages. And what is the third going to be? And I'd like to suggest that the opportunity is not just to have a golden age in the automotive industry or the music industry, but across the board. That it is possible to now systematize and make innovation reliable, predictable, and we can do it again and again. And if you want to know how innovation works, well, the Reese's Peanut Butter Cup.
Taste great together. Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. Real milk chocolate, delicious peanut butter.
Reese's Peanut Butter Cups.
And Reese's Crunchy Peanut Butter Cups, topped with chopped peanuts.
Mmm, yum. That's innovation. That's really all it is. If you read all the innovation literature, you can read books like Steven Johnson's Where Good Ideas Come From. It really comes down to one thing. And just to be as provocative as possible, in the mixed mental arts community, we call it idea sex. Two ideas that have never existed before have sex. Chocolate's great, peanut butter's great, what if we put them together? Now obviously there's then work beyond that original insight to figure out, okay, how are we gonna structure this? You know, where does the chocolate go? Oh, it goes on the outside because then it's a wrapper and people can grab it and they're not, oh, but then their fingers get sticky so we need like a paper cup around it. And you know, the point is that then the guy jumps in, that weird old man who has been following these teenagers and photobombs them. But the point is that, yeah, it really is just idea sex. And if you look at Detroit's own success, you know, they basically understood, like, we want to do this in music. Wait a minute, Detroit's already had a golden age. Why don't we just figure out what the automotive industry did and bring those insights over to the music industry? And nothing seems more magical than music. And yet Motown was able to pump out, you know, 10 songs a day in that studio or more. Now, not all of them are great, not all of them are classics, but it is that sort of reliable process of innovation, and it can be systematized. And if you guys want, and this is what I think Detroit should do, and this is what Derek and I have been talking about, I think that it'd be pretty cool if Detroit, the Motor City, was the place that figured out the playbook on how you create a golden age and how you sustain it over the long term. Not so that a golden age is something that happens and then disappears, but that understands all of this well enough that we can sustainably be driving things forward for the long term. And the key to that really comes from improv comedy. If you haven't read Tina Fey's Bossy Pants, it's amazing. And, you know, the key insight of improv comedy is yes and. So when somebody has an idea, you're like, yes and. You build off of that. So rather than shutting it down, you figure out how you can build on what people have already said. But that is not our evolutionary instinct. Our evolutionary instinct is to say yes, but. And then the improv dies. And so this is a book called Outsmart Your Instincts by Adam Hansen. And Adam Hansen is at Ideas to Go, which is an innovation consultancy. He teaches Fortune 500 companies how to innovate. And Adam, who's part of the mixed mental arts community, ultimately just realized, you know, as he was reading all of this new cognitive science, that, you know, the cognitive science was actually the key to being able to make people reliable, predictable innovators. And it's because, you know, and the analogy that Adam uses is, let's imagine you have two of our Paleolithic ancestors, and we'll call them Og and Thrak. And Og and Thrak are there, and they're going through the Serengeti, and then all of a sudden there's a rustle in the bushes. Now, what does a rustle in the bushes mean? Well, you know, Og decides that it's better to not find out. Like, let's just not take a risk. Maybe it's a lion, maybe it's not, but let's just get the heck out of Dodge. So humans have this negativity bias. We tend to assume the worst, and we tend to assume that it's better to run away and live to fight another day. Whereas, you know, in the paleo period, you know, our other friend who goes to investigate, some of the times he would have found some cool new opportunity, but a lot of times he just would have gotten eaten by a lion. So the point is that we are the descendants of what Adam calls the savants of risk aversion. So we are set up to try and avoid risks rather than engaging in that improv of yes and. So that script is going to kick in for you, and it's great to understand that, so that then rather than just running away, you are willing to go through the emotional discomfort of being able to engage in that improv and see what emerges. So those two kids could have gotten really annoyed. Dude, I was eating my chocolate, and then you messed it up with your peanut butter. Or, man, my peanut butter was so good, and now there's all this icky chocolate in it. Or they could say, hey, this is an interesting thing. I don't quite know how to deal with it, but let's run with this. Let's see where it goes, and let's see what we can create together.
I was angry. You were saying things about the aptitude, and the way you were treating the team
was, you get a free pass for life.
I gotta get back on stage. We got like 2 minutes of rehearsal time left.
Do you understand how condescending that just was?
What?
I mean, maybe you don't.
I don't want to see you get dragged off.
I get a free pass for life from you. You give out the pass. You give them to me.
You're gonna have a stroke, little buddy.
What did you do? What did you do? Why has Lisa not heard of me?
Man, how many fourth graders have heard of you?
You can't write code. You're not an engineer. You're not a designer. You can't put a hammer to a nail. I built the circuit board. The graphical interface was stolen from Xerox PARC. Jeff Raskin was the leader of the Mac team before you threw him off his own project. Everything, someone else designed the box. So how come 10 times in a day, I read Steve Jobs as a genius? What do you do?
I play the orchestra. And you're a good musician. You sit right there. You're the best in your row.
I came here to clear the air. Do you know why I came here?
Can you just answer that?
I came here because you're going to get killed. Your computer's going to fail. You had a college and university advisory board telling you they need a powerful workstation for $2,000 to $3,000. You priced Next at $6,500, and that doesn't include the optional $3,000 hard drive, which people will discover isn't optional because the optical disc is too weak to do anything, and the $2,500 laser printer brings the total to $12,000, and in the entire world, you are the only person who cares that it's housed in a perfect cube. You're gonna get killed. And I came here to stand next to you while that happens, because that's what friends do. That's what men do. I don't need your pass. We go back, so don't talk to me like I'm other people. I'm the only one that knows that this guy here is someone you invented. I'm standing by you because that perfect cube that does nothing is about to be the single biggest failure in the history of personal computing.
Tell me something else I don't know.
Steve Jobs invented himself. He invented a myth. That is what geniuses have always done. And then there is the actual reality of what they do. What is behind the curtain? And what is behind the curtain is a conductor. Steve Jobs could not write code. He could not program. He didn't understand the graphical user interface. He just stole that. But what he did do is that he got all the best people to play together. And that is the improv that Steve Jobs made possible. And if we're going to talk about what young leadership is, or any kind of leadership, that is it. Around you, you have an orchestra. There's an orchestra of everybody in this room, and then there's the much larger orchestra of Detroit, and there's the much larger orchestra of humanity. And the real leaders are the ones who can get the orchestra to play together and to create beautiful music. And of course, that is what Detroit has already done. That is what an assembly line is. It's getting everybody to work in harmony and work in tandem and to produce something together greater than they could on their own. And so I found these images online. And whether you think you can or whether you think you can't, either way, you're right. And I think nothing stops Detroit. And I am really excited to see what this community can do. And anything that I can do to help you guys out, or anything the mixed mental arts community can do to help you guys out, it would be our extreme pleasure. Because I think that here is where we figure out the playbook of the golden age and how to create a sustainable culture of excellence. Thank you.
Thank you, Hunter. Doesn't look like you let me down too much out here. That's pretty happy. So one of the first questions we have here is, you talk about, you know, mixing all these ideas and bringing them all together. Well, how do you get those ideas to mix and get leadership in your companies and your families and kind of the seniors to kind of get, you know, attack that problem with you?
Yeah, I mean, you know, Mark talked about diversity, and I think the most important thing about diversity is that, you know, I mean, honestly, like, if you want to convince people of it, he's absolutely right. You have to talk about money, because that's when it's about my pocket and my bottom line, then it moves away from being this moral issue to being like, oh, we're leaving money on the table. And the key thing is, Steve Jobs said it, think different. That's your raw material. If you have a bunch of people who think the same, they cannot innovate. But then once you've brought those people together, once you've brought all those different instruments together in the orchestra, you have to get them playing together. And mostly that's about creating the right emotional environment, where you're creating that environment for improv, where people feel safe, they feel comfortable, they feel respected, they feel taken care of, where, you know, dissent or problems are encouraged, where rather than getting shouted down for voicing a problem, we're celebrated for it. And that's really the key. And, you know, this is fortunately, because humans are so socially intelligent, you already know this. You've been in rooms where there's a real improv happening and where we're all vibing and this feels really good and we're all learning from each other and we all feel comfortable throwing our two cents in. And then you've been in rooms where that doesn't feel comfortable at all. And you feel like it's much better for you to just sort of keep quiet. So a lot of it is trusting the fact that you are an animal. And as an animal, you can sense and you can pick these things up, and you can sense when the improv isn't going well, and then managing those emotional and social dynamics to create that spirit of inclusivity where we want to hear from the people who haven't said anything in 20, 30 minutes. And there's large groups of humans who haven't had a voice for a very long time.
So on that note, I mean, you've had a kind of public spat, shall we say, with Sam Harris trying to drive this process. Can you talk about a little bit about what you, I mean, give him the background on it, and then what you may have learned trying to drive that process yourself?
Yeah, so I, you know, I was born in Saudi Arabia. I've moved back and forth between the Muslim world and the Western world for my whole life. And so the experience since 9/11 has been particularly odd for me, because I've constantly had to hear in the news media about Arabs, and it didn't fit my experience of the Arab or the Muslim people at all. They're the most hospitable people on the planet. They have some of the most delicious food, and they've been very good to me and my family. And so at a certain point, I got rather fed up and frustrated with this narrative that we hear about Muslims and Arabs being terrorists. And so I decided to deliberately use what I knew about social intelligence and create some social drama. So I picked a fight. And I picked a fight with Sam Harris, who is part of the New Atheist, group and sort of drives this idea that, there's something wrong with Islam. And I don't think that there's anything wrong with Islam. What I think is that you can be a bigot no matter what your ideology is. And you can be a fundamentalist and an extremist no matter what your ideology is. There are extremists in the liberal community. There are extremists in the conservative community. There are extremists in every ideology you can imagine. And so I decided to take all of those people, those extremists, and say, you know what? You think you're different because of your ideology, but your psychology is the same. You're all the same. And understandably, they didn't really like this because you were saying that two people who were convinced that they were enemies were the same. And so Sam got rather annoyed at me, and he felt the need on a podcast, Joe Rogan's podcast, with 30 million people to say that I didn't understand the relevant biology. And this, for me, is great because my whole goal has been to create the controversy so you can teach the controversy. And what I just laid out for you is some of the relevant biology. And there's a whole lot more of it, and there's great science. And ultimately, I think that what I've really realized is that if you want to defeat these bad ideas, you have to move from science to engineering, right? Talk is cheap. We can argue about theory all day. But at a certain point, if you start producing real results in the real world, nobody can argue with that.
Thank you. And there is another fan here, apparently, because here the question is talking about some of the podcasts where you talk about the job apocalypse. Could you explain a little more detail for the rest of the audience?
Well, firstly, who is this fan? Remaining silent. That's very wise. That's very wise. So the jobocalypse is, again, my Uncle Bill works at the Ford plant in Blue Springs, Missouri. And he doesn't read a lot of the books that I read. He doesn't read, Martin Ford's Rise of the Robots or The Second Machine Age. And so he doesn't really understand necessarily the problems that are coming in terms of automation and the ways in which, Silicon Valley set out to disrupt everything. And that is exactly what they have done. They have disrupted everything. And so what we did is that rather than sort of talking abstractly or saying everybody should read these books, we decided to boil it down to one word, jobocalypse. There is a job apocalypse happening right now, and it is coming. It's obviously coming in trucking. It's coming in terms of even driving more generally. And obviously, a lot of that innovation is coming out of here. But it's happening in a whole bunch of other ways. Automating of accounting, automation of legal work, even medical work is increasingly being done by AI and software. And so this massive shift requires a response. And, this may be controversial to say, but I have some bad news. Our jobs did not go to China. They may have in the short term, but the much larger force that is happening here is automation. And so we are living in a jobocalypse, and our fellow humans need a lot of help adjusting and transitioning to this new world, and that's what we're focused on doing.
And this will help lead into our next speaker, but one question to ask. As an advocate for education, can we truly figure out the rules for a golden age without fixing the education system for all?
Nope. But I think the important thing is that, it's a question of sequencing. And so, the big problem is that I could now, right now, articulate a plan for what education should look like. But in order to enact any sort of change in a democracy, you need buy-in. And that requires you have to have a public that is educated and informed enough to even know what educational system they would want. And so, this really comes down to resources versus resourcefulness. And the resources that we have right now are the internet, we have YouTube, we have all of that. And so, before we can even get enough consensus to be able to reform our government, which needs some reform, we first have to build that groundswell of a public that knows what they want, what they're fighting for, and ultimately what things should look like. And I think the most valuable idea that I've heard in the last 9 months around that is these two UK-based artists who are also a husband and wife. And so obviously they spent a lot of time together. And they said, we realized long ago that we could either gang up on each other or gang up on the problem. And so we have a lot of problems to gang up on. And, you know, right now we're just focused on getting together as many people online and in the real world to start ganging up on those problems. But ultimately, the big problem is reforming our education system and our government.
Two more quick questions, with the first being, what do you think about young people jumping jobs? Is it good for them long term?
Do they have an option? I mean, the average lifespan of companies increasingly is like 10 years. So I think that's the thing, is that it's great that a lot of people got to live in a time when your company was loyal to you and you could be loyal to your company, but that is not the world that we live in anymore. And part of it is that, you know, as a person who is living in that world, that everyone has to be an innovator now. And if you're going to be an innovator, you need to be able to think differently and have lots and lots of different experiences to draw from. So I think that, you know, it would be nice if, you know, I mean, Mark has offered me a job. I don't know how long he can guarantee it for, but Mark may also have to respond to things happening in the economy that he can't necessarily control.
Very good. And one last question that's more of a chance for you to plug. You mentioned a lot of books and information. Where can they get more information on this stuff and break it down and without reading a 500-page book?
Well, so that's the big problem with academics is, so academic culture is called weird culture, Western educated, industrialized, rich, and democratic. And part of that weirdness is that they're super atomistic. So they tend to focus on one little idea, and then they write a 400-page book that is all about that one idea. And so this is super subversive, but we realize that you could just extract that idea, and then people don't need to read the book. And so that's really what we're focused on doing in the Mixed Mental Arts community. You can find us at mixedmentalarts.co. But we're literally just taking all these ideas from these books, and we're now going to whittle all those 150 books into the Mixed Mental Arts belt system. So it'll be 9 concepts that everybody needs to navigate the jobocalypse. And you can find that at mixedmentalarts.co.
Perfect. And with that, thank you, Hunter.
Thank you, everybody. Yeah.